I'm Lee Rayburn in for Larry Mueller today on The Larry Mueller Show, and we're taking you up and down the mighty Mississippi River this hour with our guest, the editor and publisher of Big River Magazine, Reggie McLeod. The July-August issue is out now, and the big headline to start it all off on the cover is, "We did it!" exclamation mark. We'll find out more about that, as well as some of the other stories in this current issue of Big River Magazine, along with your help, your questions, and your Mississippi River stories along the way. Let us know what you love about the Mississippi, or why you call the Driftless region home and would welcome everybody else to visit. Our phone number is 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email us, talk@wpr.org. And Reggie, welcome back to the Larry Mueller Show.
Well, thank you. Good morning, Lee.
Yeah, and I understand some changes are underway at Big River Magazine, and that has to do with the big "We Did It" on the cover of the July-August issue.
Yes, we started about 32 and a half years ago, and this current issue is the first one that's published as a nonprofit. We've become a nonprofit magazine as of May. So that's a big, we've been working at it for 2.5 years. So it's not like a shock, but it is a big change in terms of how we organize and our goals and that sort of thing.
Congratulations are in order, Reggie, but what does this mean for Big River Magazine going forward?
Well, I used to be the sole boss here, and now we have a board of directors of 5 people up and down the river, actually. It's a great group with a lot of expertise in a variety of areas. And we have some big goals. We want to create an online database with all of the back issues in a searchable format.
Sure.
This is the 240th issue, the current one, and there's a lot of good resources there on history and critters and environmental issues and so on. We also want to do more investigative pieces, perhaps get some grant or funding that will allow us to do that. Hmm. And also, we want to resume having public meetings up and down the river. Before COVID, we would have usually about 4 meetings during the winter and get people together and ask them about local river issues and answer questions about what we're doing and just kind of talk about the river and things.
Sure, and get some ideas for some stories or maybe a few authors and photojournalists that might be interested in contributing.
That too. Some of our longtime writers are people that we met at these gatherings.
Yeah.
So it'll be great to get out there again.
So you mentioned that this Big River magazine goes back more than 30 years now, but it didn't begin as a magazine, right? It just started as a little old newsletter at the start of 1993.
Yeah. I don't think of it as a little old newsletter, but yeah, the first.
Just saying, it's come a long way.
Yes, it has. The first few issues were just 6 pages, and I kind of saw it as something that would be useful for river professionals. And at the time, I'd been working as a freelancer. I worked for a lot of different publications through the 80s into the early 90s. And it kind of evolved and grew, and around 2000, we started having color in the magazine, which makes the photos look a lot more interesting, and having advertisements, which are, I'm proud to say, are mostly small, locally owned businesses in the Driftless area, which is the stretch of river we cover. And we've grown since then, slowly.
Oh, indeed. And so the July-August issue is out now, and it starts with the big news that Big River Magazine's now published by a nonprofit called Big River Voice. And it's a transition to a not-for-profit publishing system. And Reggie, now you've got a board of directors to answer to.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And I'm on the board of directors.
Okay.
So I get a voice. We have Terry Goodman down in Dubuque, who helped start the Big River Museum down there, and she worked for the city of Dubuque and has really helped start up a number of different nonprofit river organizations over the years. And one of our news editor, actually, who lives down in Sebula, Iowa, and Galena, Illinois, she's kind of back and forth. She's on the board of directors. We have John Sullivan, who was working for the Wisconsin DNR for many years. He was in charge of water quality in the stretch of the Mississippi River that borders Wisconsin. And we have Ron Cruz up in the Twin Cities, who originally was a journalist, but he started a couple nonprofits that have to do with environmental issues. And the last job he had before he retired was he was the head of the Mississippi River program for the McKnight Foundation up in Minneapolis. So we've got a lot of depth in this board. It's pretty exciting. It's really good to have the help from all these people who know a lot of things that I don't know. So.
Well, it sounds to me, Reggie, as though you have organized a group of stewards for the Mississippi River as your board of directors for the Big River magazine.
Yes, broadly speaking, that's what we do. We focus on journalism, covering the area, hoping that that will help the health of the river and the communities in this stretch from the Twin Cities down to the Quad Cities.
Yeah, and you mentioned one of your board members focusing on water quality, and your recent new issue of Big River Magazine, the July-August issue, has a story about a new 10-year water quality plan that came from the Mississippi Watershed Management Organization.
Yeah, that's an organization that in Minnesota, it's a formal, and I think there may be these in other states, but it's a formal organization that takes care of the runoff for a certain area. And this particular organization is on the upstream end of the Twin Cities. And, you know, they spent decades and billions of dollars building storm sewers to get the water into the river as quickly as possible. And that's carried a lot of pollution into the river, soil and fertilizers and motor oil and various things. And now they're spending millions of dollars keeping that stuff out of the Mississippi River and getting it so that more of the rain soaks into the ground as it should. And that will improve the water quality of the Mississippi River at the same time. So they've done a lot of big projects up there. One of the big ones was the golf course. But they've changed a lot of streets and a lot of buildings. The runoff from parking lots and the buildings themselves go into ponds and slowly infiltrate into the groundwater. And they also support, you know, trees and kind of a rain garden. It's these rain gardens and just contouring the land, changing. They even have storm sewers now that basically leak. So they have junctions that they bury where several storm sewers come together, and the water can, if they get a big rush of water, it fills up that container, and then it's some of it slowly infiltrates down into the soil. So they're working on a lot of innovative things up there in the city.
One of my big takeaways from that story was just how dirty that upper Mississippi River water used to be because of how we would see it as just a place to flush everything away.
Oh, yeah. Below the Twin Cities, from the Twin Cities all the way down to Lake Pepin, there were virtually no fish. It was basically dead. There were surveys in the early 20th century where they would find one or two fish in that whole stretch of the river. And now there's really excellent smallmouth bass fishing in the Twin Cities. That's a big deal up there now. And however, there are still issues. They don't eat the bass up there because there's PFAS and, you know, some other pollution problems up in that stretch. But a lot of the waste that went into the river, and actually, you know, a lot of the runoff now is not going in there, and that's helped it improve steadily. In fact, they had sewer systems there that when they had a heavy rain, the storm sewers mixed up with the sewage system.
Yeah.
So they fixed that back in the 90s, in the 1990s. It's kind of late, yeah.
Not that long ago where it's not something worth remembering. And it also drives home the value of organizations like the Mississippi Watershed Management Organization, which you feature in the current issue of your magazine, because this water quality focus would not have happened in large part without them. And we're still dealing with these things today, as your magazine talks about 3M looking to deal with PFAS runoff into the Big River.
Yeah, they've rerouted a creek that used to run through a landfill that had PFAS in it. So they decided, they invested doing a detour around the landfill. And this creek eventually, you know, its water ends up in the Mississippi River, too. In fact, that's one of the first places where they found a lot of PFAS, was in the kind of the lower end of the Mississippi in the Twin Cities, down around Cottage Grove and upstream of Hastings and that.
So the water quality issues persist, and the organizations that look towards creating a 10-year plan of keeping it clean remain up. I would argue would remain important in water quality along the Mississippi.
Oh, yes. And all of these watershed organizations kind of plan in 10-year increments. But some of the cooler things I think they're doing is they're daylighting creeks in some of them. So with these creeks, of course, they spent millions of dollars turning into storm sewers. They're trying to open them up so that there are creeks again on the surface. Hmm. And so their wildlife can live there, and they're connecting. Some of them run out of lakes, so you could actually connect the Mississippi River to a lake via a creek that has been a storm sewer for 100 years. So, yeah, it's pretty interesting, but it's interesting because we're kind of going back to the way things were, to a degree. Of course, where the creeks are a lot cleaner than they were 100 years ago, too. So,
but the way you explain it, Reggie, also makes it sound like the main artery that runs the blood through the heart of this country.
Yeah.
I mean, it sounds like a living organism, the way you explain it, and the desire to keep that running clean and free. I kind of appreciate the analogy. Reggie McLeod is our guest. He is the editor and publisher of Big River Magazine, with a July-August issue out now. And also looking for your stories along the mighty Mississippi or the Driftless region, and what you have to share or questions you might have for Reggie, perhaps some story ideas for the future Big River Magazine itself. You can join our conversation at 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email talk@WPR.org. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Larry today, and you're listening to The Larry Mueller Show. Stay with us after noon today as we talk about aging gracefully and how to care for your mental health as you get older. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Larry today on The Larry Mueller Show, and right now we're talking about the newest issue of Big River Magazine, out now, and some of the stories you'll find in it, some of the pictures, and an invitation for you to make some suggestions about what you'd like to see or hear in a Big River Magazine in the future. 1-800-642-1234 is a number to join us. That's 800-642-1234, and let's go to Lyric in Madison. Lyric, good morning.
Good morning. I'm so delighted to hear Reggie on today. I'm a second-generation subscriber of Big River Magazine, and I own a cottage in Crawford County on the Big River Road. So it belonged to my great-grandfather and recently come into my property, and we have a big stack of Big River Magazines on the table.
Oh, awesome.
In our cottage, and we look out over Highway 35 and the railroad tracks and the National Wildlife Refuge that's right there. And I really, really appreciate the work of Big River, and your publication has really expanded my connection to different opportunities in the area, and to different agencies that are doing good work on the river. And I'm really excited about the idea of having that digital archive of all of your previous issues. So just wanted to thank you very much for your great work, Reggie.
Lyric, great. Awesome. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
Lyric, you're in Crawford County, you mentioned. I wanted to ask you about the closure of the Black Hawk Bridge and what you've seen there, if anything, so far.
Well, you know, I've just I've just, driven by it and around it, but...
Yeah, out of commission
until
2027. And Reggie, you write about it in Big River, this issue of Big River Magazine. But it's not the only bridge closure around us across the Mississippi right now.
No, that's true. But it is an unfolding story, actually. There's things, a lot of things happening with it. But the bridge in Clinton, one of the bridges in Clinton, Iowa, is closed between Clinton and Fulton, Illinois.
Mm-hmm.
There are two of them, and this is for routine deck maintenance. And fortunately, they have two bridges. Generally, the bridges are spaced about 30 miles apart on the river, and with the exception, notable exception, of between Prairie du Chien and Dubuque. There's a Cassville Ferry, which is where perhaps a bridge should be, and the town of Cassville and Guttenberg, too, to a degree, have been kind of lobbying for a bridge there. But, when the bridge is closed at Lansing, it's going to be really rough on a lot of people and on the businesses in town. You know, there are teachers and, all kinds of people who work on one side and live on the other side.
Sure.
They're used to having that bridge. And, it was closed this summer, then it reopened, and now they're going to close it again. They're going to tear it down in September now, which is pretty dramatic. One of the things that we want to write about in the next issue, September, is, and I don't have the numbers at hand, but a lot of people don't realize that most of the Mississippi River bottom is, 100 or more feet of sand and gravel underneath. The bedrock is way, way, way down there, hundreds of feet in places. And the footings for that Black Hawk Bridge are relatively shallow. And I wish I could tell you the exact depth, but when they build bridges today, they make those footings a lot deeper. And they'll have the new bridge done, and they started the new bridge a couple of years ago. But that has much deeper footings, and, it's wider and safer, in a lot of ways. But that Black Hawk Bridge, the footings have been shifting, and the work driving the footings in deeper on the new bridge has been affecting the shallower footings on the old bridge, and that's happening. And, you just can't, especially since the accident up in the Twin Cities back in 2007, 13 people died when that bridge collapsed. They just can't take chances with bridges. So, but that's going to be tough. They have a water taxi there now kind of standing by. That they used earlier in the summer when the bridge closed for a while. And they're trying to arrange a ferry that can carry cars back and forth, which, of course, doesn't work in the winter, but it would work, maybe half the year. But there aren't a lot of, good ferry boats sitting around waiting. you can't go to a used boat place and buy a ferry boat. So that might be difficult to do, but I hear that they're working pretty hard to try to get a ferry there.
Well, and it makes me wonder about the condition of some of the older bridges along the Mississippi and when those might have to look towards repair or being rebuilt.
Yeah, well, they really ramped up, so to speak, they ramped up the inspections after the bridge collapse in Minneapolis. And I know the Winona Bridge here by where I live is, they were inspecting it, and this is a month or two after the bridge collapsed up there. And one of the inspectors was tapping on a rivet, and when the paint, there were several layers of paint, that collapsed, and there was no rivet there. So the paint was shaped like the head of a rivet, but that rivet underneath the paint had long ago rusted out. So when she did that, she went to her boss, and they put up the blockades right that instant. They didn't call anybody or anything. They just stopped all the traffic. And that caused some chaos around here for a while. And they did build a new bridge, but after that opened, they fixed up the old bridge. So we have two bridges now.
So you suspect more stories to come about the bridge in Black Hawk Bridge in Crawford County?
Well, it'll be, they haven't, as far as I know, they haven't said when the old bridge is coming down.
Yeah.
And the new bridge, they're saying, will be done in 2007. I mean, it takes a long time to build a bridge now. And I have a feeling the engineers are looking at ways they might be able to speed that up. And I don't know if they're going to, they kind of move along it as fast as they can anyway. But I'll bet they're having meetings about that now, because that's going to be a big gap for, you know, 2 years
right.
not having a bridge.
Between now and 2027. Let's go to Tom and Nina next. Tom, good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call. I'm glad to hear about the water quality improvements in the Mississippi River. And we also understand the Hexagenia mayfly is an important aquatic organism in the Mississippi River. And in the 70s, it had been basically wiped out down to Winona from the metropolitan area of St. Paul and Minneapolis. Unfortunately, though, now that, you know, after the mayflies have recovered, there's evidence again that there are new forms of pollutants that are beginning to decimate the mayfly populations again in the Mississippi River. So we have to be diligent about causes of pollution, and the current hypothesis is that it's probably from the agribusinesses in the pesticides that are being used, but it would be a terrible thing to lose the Hexagenia bilineata population of mayflies in the Mississippi River.
What would be the domino effect of that as you see it, Tom?
It would fish rely on the birds, the fishermen, and just the aesthetics to lose an organism like that that's so iconic and representative of the Mississippi River. It would just be a terrible sin to have occur.
Tom, thank you. And certainly an idea, Reggie, about the Hexagenia mayfly and its threatened population along the Mississippi.
Yeah, insects in general are in decline, and part of it, a lot of people are pointing to neonicotinoids, which is a new class of insecticides that are very potent and persistent, and that kills all the insects. They're a good insect. I mean, we define this. All the insects have a purpose in the big plan, but we define good insects and bad insects, and the huge majority of insects are good insects. And birds have to eat insects for part of their life. Even hummingbirds have to eat insects because when birds are raising their young, they need protein. They're not looking for carbohydrates or sugar. They need protein to feed the babies. And so they can grow so quickly and migrate or whatever. And as the insects decline, the birds, the populations have declined a lot. And we had a story a couple issues ago about trout streams, and they're starting to see declines of some of the insects in trout streams because these neonicotinoids are everywhere. And in some places, before you can introduce a new chemical into the environment, it has to be tested and approved. And in the U.S., you start using it, and sometimes decades later, like PFAS, they were manufacturing PFAS starting in the early 50s, and here just a few years ago, everyone goes, wow, it's everywhere, and it's probably killing people. It's in the drinking water in a lot of places, and I don't know.
Yeah, we don't know what it's doing so far. We're still yet to figure it out. We've let loose the PFAS without understanding them completely, and now it seems to be quite ubiquitous. I absolutely see that. But you're talking about these birds requiring protein and needing insects at some point in their life as part of their food cycle and diet. And hands down, the best bird pictures in this Big River Magazine issue, the July-August issue, Reggie McLeod, has to be Tom Watson's as he takes a wildlife viewing from a kayak up and down a river of ways there. And he's got a story to go with it. But the photos he got, I think, are something special and need to be seen.
Yep, I agree. That's a fun story. Mm. And, you know, when you're out on the river in the water and you're in a motorboat, it's a whole different river than when you're in a canoe or a kayak. And there are a lot of places you can go to in a canoe and kayak where you really can't get to in a motorboat. And Tom writes a story about that and just how you can kind of drift up on animals, and sometimes they'll just look at you. 'Cause they're, you know, they don't hear anything. They're not sure what that is. And I found that actually on a bicycle and bike trails a couple of times. I've biked really early in the morning, got out right at sunrise, and I've gone right by deer where I could reach out and touch them.
Wow.
If I wanted to. I didn't want to startle them. But the same is true on the river. It's really nice. You can kind of back a canoe or a kayak back into some rushes or cattails sometimes and just kind of watch things. And Tom does a great job about talking about that and some of the experiences he's had where he's been surprised. Once a deer ran across a floodplain forest and jumped in the water right in front of him, and he watched it swim across the channel there. And
do you call a group of white pelicans a flock of pelicans? I'm trying to think what this is, but it's got to be at least 36 pelicans all grouped together on a little body of water here that I'm looking at.
I'm pretty sure they're called something else, and I'm pretty sure I don't know what it is, Lee. Maybe a raft.
A raft of pelicans makes sense because they're so close together. You could probably float on it.
Might be something else. Well, one of the really cool things about the pelicans up here, you know, the ones that you see down in the seacoast are individuals, the gray pelicans, and these white pelicans really hunt in groups, and they will actually drive fish into shallow water and then go and feed in the fish, and they talk and to each other in pelican language, of course. But also they do a thing called kettling, where they'll be up in the air and they'll fly around in a circle, and I've seen that over La Crosse, over downtown La Crosse, over downtown Winona, in different places. And a lot of times early in the morning they'll do this, and it's like a big column of pelicans, and there might be like 30 or 40 pelicans.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden they'll leave in like two or three groups sometimes and go in entirely different directions. And it's almost as if they're having a little meeting up there and deciding what they're going to do. That they're really fun to watch, and they're huge. I mean, you can't really see it in this picture, or even when you see them flying, but I think they have like 8-foot wingspans or something like that. They're huge birds.
Yeah, and as you mentioned, there's something you would see solitary in the south, but here they seem to be working in cahoots.
Yeah, they're very communal. And it's a different species, you know, it's a different species. But sometimes I've been out fishing in the backwaters, you know, and sometimes you want one more cast and it starts to get dark. And the pelicans, I've seen, you know, groups of pelicans flying in and landing and all kind of congregating in the same area from different directions, you know. So I think they have quite a social life, actually.
That is very cool. And you can see that in the beautiful pictures from Tom Watson in this issue of the Big River magazine. And as long as we're talking about what the birds eat, we might as well talk about what we eat as well, because your new issue of the magazine, Reggie, has a one-of-a-kind restaurant experience in the Driftless region, a farm-to-table French restaurant that was an old church?
No, they built the church.
They built the church. It looks like an old church.
It's a hermitage. Monks and nuns, largely, many of them are French. And, yeah, it's a beautiful little church. And it's over between Soldiers Grove and Gay's Mills, which is a little out of the way in terms of, you know, you hear people say build a restaurant, you got to think of three things: location, location, and location.
But these guys thought if we build it, they will come. So
they are coming. Yeah, and it was great fun. It's just half the fun is driving there. Actually, it's such a beautiful area. Mm-hmm. But the two nuns that were serving in the dining room are both French, and It took a long time to have dinner. Nobody's in a hurry. Don't go there if you're in a hurry. But it was really charming. The food was excellent. I had monkfish for the first time in my life.
And oh, wow.
I'm going to have it again. I'm looking forward to it. And, oh, boy, the desserts and, you know, baked goods are exquisite. It's
called the St. Francis Hermitage. It's east of Gay's Mills, and it's an organic farm-to-table French restaurant that actually has French nun and clergy as part of the staff?
Yeah, monks and nuns. And they actually grow a lot of the food and put it up, preserve it, and process it, and things like that.
Do we know where this idea came from? It's such a neat, out-of-the-way destination sort of experience that, again, it's one of a kind that I wouldn't have found otherwise.
Well, you know, hermitages used to, in the old days, you know, they were self-supporting. So, a duke or a count or something would give some land to the church, and a bunch of monks or nuns would go out there, and they'd build houses, and they'd grow their own food and make their own wine or beer. And I had to think of that. And you know, they were self-sufficient. They would basically be self-sufficient. And they're still doing that in some places. There are a few places along the river. There's a group, and I'm not going to remember all the names. There's a group of monks on the bluff above Dubuque, and there's a St. Francis Center by La Crosse, and there's another one on the Minnesota side between Winona and La Crosse where nuns have a hermitage. So and they don't, you know, they don't have a big presence. This is the only place I know of that has a restaurant. The place in La Crosse has a lot of programs and classes and things like that, but some of them are very you know, you hardly know they're there. They're praying and you know, living a religious life, and that's their whole purpose there. So
the St. Francis Hermitage, put it on your map and make sure you find it in the new issue of Big River Magazine right now. Our guest is the editor and publisher, Reggie McLeod, and want to take a moment to invite you to the conversation at 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Share your Mississippi River stories, your favorite spots in the drift list, or what you'd like to see in future issues of Big River Magazine. Talk at WPR.org is also an acceptable way to get a hold of us anytime, anyway. You have this very interesting story in this issue of Big River Magazine, Reggie, about Great Cloud Island, which is actually now two islands, but both of them seem to be being challenged by mining industries, the threat of expansion, and what this might mean for the small community that calls Great Cloud Island home.
Well, yeah, that's interesting. That's mining's been going on there for a long time, actually. And it was one island, but what happened when they built the lock and dam system, most of the locks and dams were built in the 1930s. I have to include the century now. I'm just getting used to it. Anyway, the 1930s, and so they raised the whole point is to raise the level of the water so that there's a 9-foot channel for the towboats. So when you raise the water a foot or two, a lot of land suddenly becomes submerged. Mm-hmm. So that's what happened to Great Cloud Island. What was a lake in the larger island kind of became a channel separating the two islands.
And this is up near the Twin Cities.
Yes, it's up between Cottage Grove and Inver Grove Heights in the Twin Cities, just upstream of Hastings a little bit. And so they've been mining aggregates there, so with sand and gravel, basically, for, I can't tell you when they started, but for, I think, most of the 20th century. And because things like that are very cheap and they're very expensive to haul because they're very heavy, they've been doing most of the shipping by barge from there. So a lot of the construction in the Twin Cities and in that whole area has had sand and gravel from this island. But, of course, as they mine it, it disappears. So that's been happening, and it's of archaeological significance. There was a Dakota community on the island, an Indian community, and it was named after Gray Cloud, who was a woman who lived there in the 1800s.
Oh.
And there were stories that it was haunted. The author of the story grew up, and he lives in Madison now, but by the way, Denny Kniff, he was one of the people that started the River Alliance of Wisconsin. But he grew up in Hastings, and when he was in high school, people were talking about going to the cemetery at Gray Cloud Island at night and seeing ghosts and things like that. And there's a lot of stories associated with that island, and I've paddled around it. Actually, I spent the night in one of the little harbors that's in Gray Cloud Island that was probably created from the mining in a houseboat.
Any ghosts?
I didn't see any.
Yeah.
I didn't go on the island. But there's also a really nice rocky bluff along the west side of the upper island that's a very picturesque part of the river. It's neat, and he did a really nice story on it, and now the mining company wants to, and I mentioned earlier that the river bottom is hundreds of feet of sand and gravel. Mm-hmm. This mining company wants to have a really deep mine, several hundred feet deep in the river bottom, right near the main channel. By the island, they're trying to get the permits for it, and a lot of people are going to oppose that because it may have a big effect on the river and who knows what else, because sand and gravel moves around a lot.
Sure, but ultimately the story may be, as you point out in Big River Magazine, that Gray Cloud could be annexed out of existence if it's not careful.
Yeah.
It could go away.
Yeah, it could go away. I mean, they could. I mean, the whole thing is sand and gravel, basically, really, except for the rocky part on the upper island.
We got a call here from Rachel in La Crosse. Let's go there next. Rachel, good morning.
Good morning. I'm so excited to have gotten through.
Awesome. Welcome.
Yeah, so I live in La Crosse, which, of course, the river is a great part of our city here, and the activities here, and I'm not a fisherman. I like to, get in the water and swim around a little bit, but what we really like to do is look for agates.
Yes.
Now, geologically speaking, they're not in our area because we're in this driftless region, so we find a lot of fossils. However, in your knowledge of the river bottoms, what are some places when you get north of here that you start finding them along shorelines, beaches, whatever?
Great question, Rachel. Reggie, where do we find these agates?
It is a great question, and I wish I had a great answer, Rachel. We did a story many years ago, and I remember Connie Cherba wrote it. And these agates typically are found on Lake Superior. That's where people find a lot of them. But, the glaciers moved a lot of sand. And in fact, a lot of the sand and gravel in the river came from up north and was pushed around by the glaciers. And there are areas on the river where people find agates. I couldn't tell you offhand. I believe if I had that database, I could look it up, and that would be the good thing about having the database. But I believe above Red Wing, up above Lake Pepin,
Okay. There
are places where people find agates. But I wish I could be more specific about it. Unfortunately, without spending a little time on it, I couldn't tell you.
Well, yeah, Rachel, hang tight for that archive of Big River magazines to go online, and in the not-so-distant future, it may just be a few clicks away.
Something on our website, which is at bigrivermagazine.com, and I'll see if I... We have a spreadsheet that lists all the stories and the writers, and I could look up Connie's stories and maybe get that one and see if we can post it.
Rachel, thank you for the call. Reggie McLeod, our guest, editor and publisher of Big River Magazine. Its July-August edition is out now with the pictures and the stories of the heart of the main artery that runs through this country and how it pumps the lifeblood through somewhere near wherever any of us are today. It's kind of hard to wrap your head around, and yet it's certainly something worth featuring, celebrating, and arguably keeping clean as well. Wanted to invite you to join us in the conversation at 1-800-642-1234 or talk at WPR.org. We'll continue with Reggie next. I'm Lee Rayburn on The Larry Mueller Show. Don't miss tomorrow on Garden Talk here on The Larry Mueller Show. We'll hear about vertical gardening with our one of our favorite guests, Melinda Myers. We'll also take a look at your fertilizer and how to keep it as fresh as possible coming up tomorrow from 11 to 1 here on Garden Talk on The Larry Mueller Show. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Larry today, and our guest is the editor and publisher of Big River Magazine with its July-August issue out now. Reggie McLeod joins us, and if you'd like to join our conversation, we invite you to it at 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email talk at WPR.org. Reggie, Lee Hendricks was a deckhand on the Mississippi back in 1972, making just $25 a day. But as he points out, you could quickly work your way up to be a captain of a barge for about $40,000 a year in those times, which was some good money back then. And he's got a story about tariffs, embargoes, and towboats on the Mississippi that really captured my attention and sort of ties in where we are now compared to where we were more than 40 years ago.
Yes, and that was Lee's story idea, and I liked it because I knew that a lot of towboat owners were concerned about the tariffs that are being applied to different countries.
Mm-hmm.
And China is one of the main purchasers of grain from the U.S., and much of that grain goes down the Mississippi River in towboats. In fact, if you see a towboat going downriver, those barges that it's pushing are probably full of corn or soybeans, and they probably won't be unloaded until they get down to New Orleans, where they're put on a ship that goes off to another country. So these tariffs are affecting things. And the tough thing is a lot of contracts have already been signed,
mm-hmm.
you know. So a lot of the grain trade has shifted to Brazil and other countries because they can get a better price down there, and they don't have to worry about tariffs because they don't know if there'll be tariffs on the grain when it comes down the river or not, too. So that uncertainty is kind of spreading, and I think a lot of farmers are very concerned about that because they have to make decisions about how much they're going to plant in the winter. You know, they're
right.
figuring that out. And this year looks like a really good year weather-wise for the corn harvest and the bean harvest. And when that happens, the price goes down. So my point is that it's very complex. All the economics of this and the way that the prices shift. And he writes a story about how the people that run the barge lines have to kind of make some decisions. They're making decisions now about the fall. Most of that grain moves, you know, in October and November, you know, is the big rush. And there's a lot of barge traffic in those months. And he draws a parallel to when we had an embargo on trade with the Soviet Union back in the
late 70s.
That was in the late 70s.
Yeah. It was President Carter's grain embargo on the former Soviet Union, and how you can find parallels to that today with the proposed tariffs on China.
Yeah, a lot of people lost their jobs on the river during that embargo. and a lot of deckhands lost their jobs, and boats were idle, and shipping companies went out of business and all of that. So he draws a parallel.
Yeah.
And it's interesting to see that, and we won't know how it turns out until, you know, probably the winter. They'll be looking back on it and tallying up the figures and that kind of things. But I don't envy the people that have to make those decisions now. And he also points out that a lot of the people that have to make those decisions weren't alive in the late 70s.
Yes.
So it's all new to them, but some of the old hands in some of these places are thinking about that time a lot, because it's a rough situation to be in.
Well, and to get it from the perspective of a guy who started as a deckhand on the river, I thought was what made this story special and different and gave it a perspective that I wouldn't have found outside this issue of Big River Magazine.
Well, Lee is very experienced. He worked for the Army Corps of Engineers for a while. He was captain of the largest towboat on the river, which is the MV Mississippi for the Army Corps. And besides working on a lot of, you know, just boats pushing barges all over the river and the Ohio River, all the rivers, he's also an excellent writer. He's been writing for us since the early years of the magazine, and he just came out with a book called Peep Light, which has a whole bunch of stories about the river, many of which appeared in Big River Magazine, but also some new ones. And that's a new hardcover book that I've been seeing in bookstores. I was just doing some traveling last week, and I visit bookstores very often, and it was on the shelf.
Peep Light,
and that's the light at the very first barge. See, a tow on the upper river can be 15 barges all tied together, three across and five long. So that's really a long. That's like 1,200 feet. And so the pilot only knows where the front of that barge is at night, on a dark night, because there's a little light right on the end, the peep light. So you kind of follow the peep light, which is a joke. But that's what he's referring to in the title.
Lee Hendricks is the author, and he has been a guest previously on the Larry Mueller Show. Reggie, we've got about a minute and a half left, so I'd be interested in what you are working on going forward for the future issues of Big River Magazine.
Oh, boy. I was just working this morning on a story about the Kickapoo watershed and some of the issues with the flood-controlled structures, some of which washed out in previous flooding, and the community down there is trying to figure out what to do about all of that. And I'm drawing a blank. He shifted me into the last issue, and now I have to look at the...
Well, we're going forward now.
Yes. And we've got stories about forest bathing, which is a type of which is used for treatment, used to help people. It's a therapy now. People spend time in the forest, and not only is it relaxing to draw them out of their everyday lives, but there are actually chemicals in the air in the forest that boost your immune system and that sort of thing.
All right.
There's a good story about a fishing guide, Ted Peck, down by the Iowa-Minnesota border on the river, who has a lot of experience, and he's a real interesting guy. He writes for us, but we had a reporter go out with him and be guided by Ted, and that's really amusing. That's a good story.
Fishing guide Ted Peck, a forest bathing experience in the Kickapoo watershed, all to look forward to in the upcoming issues of Big River Magazine. Editor and publisher Reggie McLeod, thanks as always for joining us today.
Okay. Thank you, Lee.
And by way of full disclosure, we should mention that Big River Magazine is one of Wisconsin Public Radio's many business sponsors. Coming up next hour, we take a look at aging and mental health and how you can keep healthy in every way as you get older. It is possible. Our experts will show us the way. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Larry Mueller today, and you're listening to The Larry Mueller Show.
Well, we're all doing it, so we might as well talk about it. Aging, not just getting older, but getting older gracefully. How can we do it, and how can we do it well? We'll talk a little bit about mental health as we age here today and other factors that you may have come across in your own life and questions you may have about how you can get older gracefully. Join us. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Larry Mueller today, and our guests are Dr. Art Walasek, the geriatric psychiatrist, the Associate Dean for Faculty Affairs and Development, and Professor of Psychiatry and Medicine at the University of Wisconsin School of Medicine and Public Health. Also joining us today, Jill Rankin, Executive Director of the Wisconsin Institute for Healthy Aging. Want to invite you to the conversation with your questions, your lived experiences, and how they might help others understand as they begin to get older. What do you want to know? And what stories do you have to share? 1-800-642-1234 is the number to join us. 1-800-642-1234 or email talk at WPR.org. Dr. Walasek, welcome back to WPR.
Thank you. Great to be back.
And Jill, welcome back to you.
Yes, thank you. Wonderful to be here.
Yeah, and Jill, I want to start with a little checklist that the Wisconsin Institute for Healthy Aging provides. And it's the Institute for Healthy Aging's 8 Dimensions of Wellness. Can you touch on those for us briefly?
Sure, yeah. So we know that there's multiple dimensions when we're thinking about our own personal health and our own personal wellness, and they all relate to each other. So it's not usually just one thing that we can do to make sure that we are living a well, high quality life. So that's why we incorporate all 8 dimensions of wellness into our conversations. Just an overview of what those are. We have our physical health, which is what we think about most often when we think about our health, like, you know, exercising and eating right and sleeping, those kinds of things. We talk about emotional health. That's a pretty significant component, is one of the dimensions. Environmental health, how our surroundings affect us and how we contribute to the environment as well. Financial health is, you think about finances are an important part of life, but it's actually a dimension of wellness too. Then we have intellectual health and, you know, how we're learning in life and things like that. Occupational health, which is, and I can go into the details of these later, but occupational health is really like how we're contributing to the world around us and how we spend our time. Also social health and spiritual health all come into play there.
Physical health, environmental health, emotional health, financial health, intellectual health, occupational health, social health, and spiritual health. Dr. Art Walasek, with your geriatric psychiatry understanding, how do those things play into our quality of life as we age?
Well, this is a fantastic framework. I was furiously jotting notes as Jill was talking, because this is a brilliant way of thinking about it. And, you know, it's easy in healthcare for things to get really like broken down to little chunks of problems, but it's much more helpful to kind of step back and think about the big picture and the ways that all these different dimensions can affect our health and our well-being. So I love this approach. As a geriatric psychiatrist, I'm kind of most interested in the emotion health side of things, kind of things that we can do to help maintain healthy emotions like joy and hopefulness and optimism and good connections with other people. So that ties into social health. And then in my world, we also see a lot of folks who are having cognitive problems and perhaps even dementia. And so the intellectual health also jumped out as me. But these all interact with each other quite a bit to help determine how folks are doing.
Dr. Walasek, what's the best way to approach somebody to talk about how they're feeling or to inquire about their wellness? What's a good, solid approach that's safe to do?
Yeah, no, it's a great question. And I would start with thinking about, you know, emotions are normal. So like we all experience a wide range of emotions, from happiness and joy to sadness and loss and grief when things don't go well, to anxiety and worry. There's certainly a lot of stressful things going on. And so emotions are a normal part of human life. Where we start to get worried that something more pathologic might be happening is if those emotions are leading to a lot of distress, mm-hmm. they're leading to problems with day-to-day life, or if they're even potentially leading to safety concerns, like things related to people saying that they don't want to be alive anymore and thinking about death and suicide. On that note, I should add, we've had the addition of the 988 a behavioral health crisis line, national number that launched a few years ago. Okay. That has been an extraordinarily helpful initiative. And rates of suicide in the U.S., which have been climbing for many years, have actually plateaued over the last couple of years. And it's not clear how much 988 has to do with that, but it may be a factor of public health intervention that's been helpful. So in terms of approaches, I mean, I would ask, I think that just sort of normalizing it as, hey, this is a thing that we talk about how we're feeling.
So how are you feeling?
How are you feeling?
How are you feeling? It's a tough question to ask because, you know, I think there's a lot of people who would rather not tell you straight up, but if you ask it point blank, it may be your best path to an answer. And Dr. Walasek, you mentioned the 988 number, and it's 3 years since its inception. NPR reports it's received more than 16 million calls, texts, and chats. And so if you or someone you know is struggling with their mental health, remember, help is always available, and it's all right to seek support, and you can do so at any time by reaching out to the 988 Suicide and Crisis Lifeline by calling or texting 988 or chatting at 988lifeline.org. That's just 988 or online at 988lifeline.org. Jill Rankin, as I go through your eight tenets here of dimensions of wellness, I want to think that there are plenty of things in my life that I can't control, but as I go through physical health, environmental health, emotional health, financial health may be one that is not necessarily up to me, but I could do some things to help control it. A lot of these things seem to be within my purview to be able to control. Social health, spiritual health, things that I can do about it.
Absolutely. And also, too, it's sometimes when I'm talking about these dimensions, I like to preface it by saying it's not about doing everything perfectly, and we can't control everything, and we're not going to have a high level of wellness in all eight of these areas at every single point in our life. So really, it's about balance. And it's about kind of just assessing, like, hey, where am I at? And maybe I want to focus on my social wellness this month, and I will just want to, you know, engage with people that feel like something that I have more control over, and that will then feed into the other areas. So it's really not about perfecting and being perfect at every single area. And things change too with our lives. You know, sometimes different periods of our life, we're going to be stronger in some areas, and then different parts of our life will be stronger in different parts. And that's okay. And sometimes it can change from day to day. So really, less pressure and more opportunity is how I look at these dimensions.
That there's opportunity to take agency over your own life and to these degrees, but to sometimes there's not. And like I would say, the thing that comes to mind is, you know, chronic illness or chronic pain can be a thing that can get in the way of physical health, and it can begin to erode things like social health or emotional health, occupational health. And then what can you do about that?
Yeah, well, I would say, you know, there's so many options because you have all these different dimensions. So for example, if you're dealing with a chronic pain or something, a chronic condition, you know, there's support groups or wherever that other people, you know, find a different social circle than what you're currently involved with. And it's an opportunity to kind of reach out and go different directions. Maybe it's not even in your social circle, but maybe you're going to focus more on your emotional health. And you're going to do a lot more exploring and maybe journaling. There's so many things that we can do for our wellness that we do have control over, even when we're experiencing challenges in one dimension or another. So the list goes on. There's so much we can do. You know, I mean, I think of sometimes in my life, I don't even just as earlier in my life as a mother of young children, it was really hard to get, you know, physical activity in when you're constantly, you know, feeding children, taking care of children, all that kind of stuff. So maybe my social wellness at that time was a lot to do with like texting and writing letters to people, talking with people on the phone versus actually going out and seeing them. But that's something I had control over. So there is a whole lot that we can do and just be flexible within each of these areas and give ourselves grace.
Give yourself some grace. Everybody, I mean, you tend to be the hardest on yourself. Nobody's as hard as you are most often. So, you know, give yourself some grace is just good advice. But Dr. Walasek, when is it time to talk to a healthcare profession about our mental health? Where would you draw that line? And I, you know, I think about this question and I feel immediately guilty that I'm somebody who's like, well, I've gotten away this long without having to talk to a therapist. I feel like I've gotten this far without it. I'll be fine moving along. But when is it time to stop and think about talking to a professional about mental health?
It's a great question. And I think any time where one's mental health or emotions are affecting the ability to do day-to-day life or causing significant distress or worry, that would be a good time to go get checked out. And really the first step would be to talk to one's primary care practitioner. So most mental health care in the United States is done in primary care. So that's a great first place to start. Primary care practitioners are trained to recognize and address depression and anxiety and other mental health issues. They may conduct a screening. So there are questionnaires that folks can answer about how severe their depression and anxiety are. There'll be medical concerns potentially to address. So medication sometimes can contribute to depression and anxiety. Alcohol and other drug use can contribute. Physical conditions. So Jill mentioned chronic pain. That's a classic example of something that can contribute to depression and anxiety. Mm-hmm. But there could be other medical conditions as well, like sleep apnea, where people have difficulty breathing at night and so on. So primary care is a great place to start because they can do a lot of that assessment of things that could be contributing to depression or anxiety. And then that practitioner may recommend some course of action that could include treatment for the depression and anxiety, and that could happen in primary care or perhaps a referral to mental health.
Dr. Art Walasek, our guest, along with Jill Rankin. Jill's the executive director of the Wisconsin Institute for Healthy Aging, and Dr. Walasek, professor of psychiatry and medicine at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health, taking a look at aging gracefully and how you can go about it and how important your attitude towards it may be in terms of your outcomes of physical health and intellectual health, spiritual health. Where do you find healthy ways to live as you get older? What questions do you have about staying healthy as you age? 1-800-642-1234 will join our conversation. That's 1-800-642-1234. Or you can email us, talk@wpr.org. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Larry today, and you're listening to The Larry Mueller Show. The Larry Mueller Show's next book club meeting is coming up. They'll be talking about The Business Trip by Jesse Garcia. The book is called The Business Trip, the author Jesse Garcia, and she'll be Larry's guest coming up Thursday, August 21st. Gives you plenty of time to still read this book about a thrilling novel that starts with two strangers meeting on a plane, and they'll take it from there. It's The Business Trip by Jesse Garcia coming up Thursday, August 21st, here on The Larry Mueller Show. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Larry today. And our guest, Jill Rankin, executive director of the Wisconsin Institute for Healthy Aging, and Dr. Art Walasek, Associate Dean for Faculty Affairs and Development and Professor of Psychiatry and Medicine at the University of Wisconsin School of Medicine and Public Health. We invite you to the conversation at 1-800-642-1234. We're talking about aging gracefully, and doing so well with a quality of life that maybe a younger you would not have thought would have been possible. 800-642-1234 or email talk@WPR.org. Got an email here from Stephanie who says she's witnessed firsthand the wonderful benefits of learning in retirement communities. She knows of two in Wisconsin, Osher in the greater Milwaukee area, and Plato, the participatory learning and teaching organization in the greater Madison area. She says both offer in-person, hybrid, and virtual opportunities to connect and learn with others. These learning and retirement communities, Stephanie says, provide affordable opportunities to continue lifelong learning, as well as wonderful opportunities to connect with other people, which supports emotional and social wellness. Checking all the boxes on the list there. And Jill, I know this is something that Wisconsin Institute for Healthy Aging focuses on.
Yeah, definitely. We encourage lifelong learning. We have so much to learn. So why not just dive in? So we do a whole lot of education on health. So I would always advocate for that. There's always something new up and coming with different health strategies that we can do to keep ourselves well. So there's definitely not a shortage of that. But really, and I know Art would probably agree with this, is that there's incredible benefits to learning something new, whether it's a new habit or it's a new topic. But we know that our brain develops new neural pathways as we learn, as we get older. So we have so much flexibility and so much opportunity as we age, and that does not end as we age.
But at the same time, there could be a social anxiety component to it. Learning new things sounds exhilarating, but meeting new people could be anxiety-inducing. Art Walasek, when it comes to that barrier to social health, what are the steps to overcoming it?
Well, first, I love that this idea was brought up. I regularly refer my patients to Plato for all the reasons that were so eloquently spelled out in that email message. Yeah, there are going to be challenges. So there could be transportation problems if it's to an in-person event. There could be technological barriers for the virtual activities. And anxiety around meeting new people could certainly be a factor as well. The best treatment for that sort of anxiety, and just to use a technical term, is exposure. So the thing that you are afraid of, like, well, another way of saying it is like to face your fear. So that that works. So if there's something that you are worried about or anxious about, actually trying and doing that thing and having a positive experience, like going to one of these groups, can really be a nice antidote to that sort of anxiety.
I love that idea. And so when it comes to that social connection, it's never too late to make friends. But I saw the news stories last week about the loneliness of young parents and isolation. And it made me wonder, in thinking about talking to both of you, how that changes as we age. Does it get easier once again once our children have left the nest? Or are there still challenges in finding those social connections and making new friends or acquaintances as we get older?
Yeah, I would say that there's more opportunity, I would say, as we get older, as we, you know, figure out the different parts of our life that we like to participate in, different hobbies, different things that we like. We tend to gravitate towards some people who have similar interests. So if you live in a community where you have those opportunities, that's great. There's a lot of online opportunities as well. Now that we do things virtually, there's kind of any kind of club or anything you want to be a part of is there. So I would say opportunities are definitely there. However, I would also encourage people not to necessarily think about quantity, because sometimes it's not about quantity of contacts and quantity of in developing new relationships. Sometimes it's about quality. And every person has a different sense, a different threshold of what feels best to them. So even if it's just developing deeper relationships with people that you already know, that can increase your social connection and increase your wellness too.
This is anecdotal, but Dr. Walasek, I wanted to ask you about this. If there are lower barriers to entry using virtual access to organizations and events, if we've seen something from COVID that may suggest that we could reduce our anxiety by not physically participating, but dipping our toe in virtually. Is there something to be said for that?
Absolutely. So there's exposure, and then there's sort of graded exposure. So you can do things in a piecemeal fashion and get closer to the thing that you want to do. So if participating in an activity virtually is a step towards perhaps a more in-person kind of participation, then that's great. So yeah, I completely agree. And you know, you can turn your camera off, you can end your interaction at any point. So it's a lot easier than to kind of get out of that experience if that becomes overwhelming. So absolutely, this has kind of created new opportunities for folks. On the other hand, people who have technological barriers, whether it's financial or physical, a lot of tech is not like super oriented towards older adults, like in terms of the size of things or accessibility and so on. So there can be some challenges that go along with the great opportunities of the technology.
Jill Rankin, from the point of view of the Wisconsin Institute for Healthy Aging, why are social connections so important for our overall health?
Well, they are incredibly important. And it's interesting that we are now in this space of elevating social connection as a public health issue. Yeah. So we do a whole lot of work in that. It's interesting to me because as a younger adult, I was educated on these dimensions of wellness and social wellness being one of them. But now we know that it has such a significant impact on our health that we know social connection social isolation and loneliness is actually a more of a risk factor for disease and poor health outcomes than smoking cigarettes, drinking alcohol in excess, having physical inactivity. All of those risk factors are certainly still risk factors for our health, but having that feeling of loneliness is actually worse than all of those factors combined. So that's why we at the Wisconsin Institute for Healthy Aging have elevated this as a priority topic area for us. Yeah. We have the Wisconsin Coalition for Social Connection, who is actively working on promoting best practices throughout the state and opportunities for adults as we age here in Wisconsin to be connected.
Dr. Walasek, is there a difference between loneliness and social isolation, and is one worse than the other?
I don't know the answer to that. Do you have a thought about that?
Sure. I can hop in here. So social isolation is an objective measure of how many contacts you have and how many people are around you. And kind of what I was saying before, a social connection is that feeling of being connected. So I could feel connected to one or two people in my life and still be socially isolated and be okay. Then there's other people who need a higher level of social connections and not being isolated. They need to be around people to feel that connection. Yeah.
We are social animals, and that much becomes clear when your social health has as much of an impact as cigarettes or drinking. But the question that keeps popping to my mind is, how do we talk about this? And Dr. Walasek, what would you say to people who are struggling with loneliness to encourage them to talk about it? How do you pop out of that loneliness bubble you find yourself stuck in?
I find myself talking with folks a lot about meaning and purpose and kind of what keeps them going, what gets them out of bed each day, why do the things that they're doing each day, and trying to link addressing loneliness and isolation to that. So, you know, if something that gives me great purpose or joy is interacting with my children and grandchildren, for example, or other members of the community, or religious and spiritual activities, then to kind of help with that, promoting that sense of meaning and purpose, well, then we should probably figure out how to get you more active in those sorts of social activities to help with meaning and purpose. So I think that's how I would link and perhaps try to motivate people to get more active in their relationships with other folks.
And doctor, what role do you see therapy playing in fighting back loneliness and dealing with it, coping with it?
Yeah, outstanding question. So talk therapy or psychotherapy is effective in older adults, just as effective in older adults as it is in younger adults. Therapy is about learning. It's about learning new ways of seeing yourself, learning new techniques, new practices, new behaviors, new ways of engaging with other people. Jill was spot on in terms of the importance of learning as we get older. And so therapy is a form of learning. So when people develop depression or anxiety, and often isolation or loneliness or stress in relationships is a contributor to that, then therapy can help with that. And so there are specific types of therapy that have to do with relationships with others and addressing problems in those relationships or forming new relationships or finding meaning in those relationships. There's another kind of therapy that's all about do more stuff. The fancy term is behavioral activation, but it basically means let's just do more. And the part of doing more is interacting more with others. So therapy is effective. It's safe. It's safer than medications. Therapy generally, except for bringing up some potentially difficult to talk about topics, is safe and well tolerated. So it's an important part of helping people who are suffering.
Do more stuff. I wrote that down. What a simple instruction to follow. Hey, try doing more stuff. See how that works for you. That's Dr. Art Walasek, Associate Dean for Faculty Affairs and Development and Professor of Psychiatry and Medicine at the University of Wisconsin School of Medicine and Public Health. Also joining us, Jill Rankin, Executive Director of the Wisconsin Institute for Healthy Aging. We invite you to the conversation as well with your questions or lived experiences at 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email talk@wpr.org. And building on what Dr. Walasek said there, Jill, meaning and purpose isn't something I would necessarily pop out of bed in the morning and think about first. But how valuable is that thought process in considering meaning and purpose as you go about your daily life as you're getting older?
Yeah, I think that fits really well into the occupational dimension of wellness, as well as the spiritual too. I think that a lot of these things cross paths, but when we think about occupational wellness, it's, you know, how are we engaging with others and how are we engaging in our community, but in a meaningful way? So how are we contributing to our community and to our society at large? So whether that's volunteering or it's a career or it's, you know, some kind of contribution that you're making. Maybe it's taking care of grandkids. Maybe it's being a caregiver of a loved one. I mean, those kinds of things will give you that sense of purpose. And I think it also bleeds into, like I said, that spiritual wellness. Also, people who have high senses of spiritual wellness, who have whether it's a strong faith or a strong connection to that outside creation, that they're knowing that they do have a purpose on this earth. And so whatever that is, it's individual for each person, but usually, and then it also bleeds into some social connection. When you feel like you feel a sense of belonging in a certain group, whether that's with a faith-based group or whether it's with your family or your coworkers or your volunteer friends, when you're part of that group, that gives you that sense of purpose also.
Dr. Walasek, what about as we get older, the concerns about substance abuse problems, alcohol and marijuana use? Where does this fit into the aging gracefully scenario?
I really appreciate that question. So I'll start with alcohol and then talk about cannabis after that. So the use of alcohol has really skyrocketed among older adults. A little bit of that was driven by the pandemic, but even before that, the rates were going up fairly dramatically. Alcohol is a nerve toxin. It kills brain cells. And so exposure to alcohol really almost in any level is potentially bad for the brain, which then means it's bad for emotions and for memory and for kind of everything else that we rely on our brains for. So it doesn't mean necessarily that you have to stop drinking at age 65, but it does mean that as you get older, you may not tolerate alcohol quite as much. So alcohol hits brain cells. Unfortunately, our brains are shrinking all the time. And so if there are fewer brain cells, alcohol has a greater effect. Our kidneys and liver change. So how we actually process alcohol changes. So our tolerance for alcohol goes down over time. And once you start developing other issues like high blood pressure, mm-hmm. Or memory problems or problems with balance and falls, alcohol is going to worsen all of those things potentially. And alcohol interacts with medications, and older adults take more and more medications potentially as they age. And so that can be an issue. And so, we really try to think about, well, what is the role of alcohol for you? Like, how valuable is that compared to some of these other health concerns? And how should we balance that? Maybe we should talk about reducing alcohol use a little bit so that you can do other things that are important to you, like walk without falling and have good memory and so on. There's a social aspect to drinking, so that gets a little bit tricky as well, you know, Friday night fish fries and all the other kind of rituals that we have. So that's important, and we don't want to get in the way of that.
Okay.
However, there are ways to enjoy that without necessarily drinking alcohol, for example. Cannabis is a little more complicated. We have less detail there about the relationship with aging, but there are downsides to cannabis use, especially with respect to memory, motivation, energy, balance, those sorts of things. So again, for both of these, it's really about trying to balance, like, well, what if any good you're getting out of this with the potential downsides?
So that would be the scales. That's what you would ask yourself. Those would be the questions to ask, is before you go for a drink or before you consume cannabis, is weighing the benefits versus what we know about the potential ill health effects?
Exactly.
Yeah. Which may not be an easy balance to make, is considering habits and how, you know, as we get older, some things just get ingrained. So Jill Rankin, I would be interested in knowing how we begin to break some habits, change our ways. The older we get, the harder it seems to be.
Yes, but we also can, like we said, we can learn at any age. So it's not even necessarily harder. I think it's just a matter of if you want to. So a lot of we have evidence-based programs that are centered around this. So we have plenty of opportunities if you go to our website at wihealthyaging.org, where we have plenty of programs that you can get into that embed developing new healthy habits within the content of the classes. So, and there's actually theory-based reasoning behind how we do these programs. But essentially, it comes down to making small short-term goals. So if you were to develop an action plan that said, you know, I want to get out and I want to start walking maybe 2 days a week. And you pick just very small steps where you're going to say, I'm going to go out on Friday morning for 10 minutes. And maybe I will go out on Saturday morning for 10 minutes. And you make a plan to do that. And you're confident that that can get done. Then once you're successful with that small short-term goal, you can build upon that. So it's really about building self-efficacy and confidence in ourselves. So if we build those small goals, then we're successful at them, then we'll keep doing it. But the key is you have to want to do it. So if you don't want to start walking, then I wouldn't pick that as your first goal. Pick something you want to do. You know, like I had a woman who in one of our classes wanted to clean out a bathroom drawer. So that was her goal, was to clean out the bathroom drawer this week. She was successful with it. And by the end of the 6 weeks that we were all meeting, she was walking because she had built up that confidence. So pick something you want to do, start working at it. And, you know, there's lots of potential there.
Well, now that you mention it, I have a kitchen drawer that could use some organizing.
Yeah.
Small goals and put it on the list. And Dr. Walasek, as we're looking, maybe take a step back and looking at the bigger picture here of how we can incorporate this in a way where we can do more stuff, we can find the joy and hopefulness and optimism in life. How important is our attitude to aging about how well we age? Is there a connection there?
It's very important. I think I'm going to introduce a word we haven't talked about yet, and that word is ageism, which is attitudes and behaviors related to ascribing certain things to a person being an older adult. And so, you know, some stereotypes about aging include, you can't learn new things, which is absolutely not true. And we brought that up over and over again. Or, well, of course, you're depressed, you're older. Also not true. Like, the vast majority of older adults do not have clinical depression, for example. And people have their own ageist attitudes about themselves. You know, you look in the mirror, you look different, you look like your parent or your grandparent. And that activates a whole set of thoughts of like, yes. Ugh, you know, I'm just getting older, I'm in pain, life is only going to get worse, et cetera, et cetera. So I think attitude is critical. And so having more positive and also realistic images of aging. So I think a lot about like the pictures that are out there of older adults. And so we can all sort of imagine, you know, say Grandpa Simpson from The Simpsons as a caricature of aging. The opposite doesn't help you though. Like a bunch of pictures of people like in their 70s skydiving, like that's cool, but that also isn't a realistic depiction of aging. And so kind of having a more positive, at the same time realistic and accepting picture of aging. So like, yep, my muscles don't work quite as well. I don't look exactly the same as I used to. That's life. I'm going to take it as it is and still do the things I want to do despite those changes.
Dr. Walasek, you just struck a chord inside me, and I have to giggle because it's not so much the external. What I'm familiar with of ageism is external ageism, is how the world sees you as getting older and maybe not as valuable. What I did not consider is internal ageism and how I see myself getting older and maybe less valuable. And using the phrase, oh, too old to whatever, does not necessarily apply. And if it does, it's only in your mind. You're not too old to start new habits. You're never too old to drop old ones or bad ones. That, you know, what you decide to do with your life is up to you until the very end of however you're going to live it.
Yep. Yeah, absolutely.
I guess I hadn't thought of ageism as an internalized thing so much before as just external. And I do want to ask you about that, Jill, but we'll get to that in just a moment. And I want to invite everybody else to our conversation about growing old gracefully and how much that has to do with how you decide to go about it, how you decide to live it. It is your life after all. So what can you do about it as you get older? 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Tom and Madison, we'll get to you in a moment. Our guest, Jill Rankin, Executive Director of the Wisconsin Institute for Healthy Aging, and Dr. Art Walasek, Professor of Psychiatry and Medicine at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Larry Mueller today, and you're listening to The Larry Mueller Show. Well, we're all getting older, so we might as well talk about it and figure out a way that we can all do it a little bit better. That's what we're doing today on The Larry Mueller Show. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Larry and our guests, Jill Rankin, Executive Director of the Wisconsin Institute for Healthy Aging, and Dr. Art Walasek, Professor of Psychiatry and Medicine at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health. We invite you to the conversation as well at 1-800-642-1234, where Tom and Madison standing by. Good afternoon, Tom.
Hey, thanks for a great show. As an aging actor and musician, I really applaud this topic. And there are definitely mornings when you look in the mirror and you think it's you. And then there are mornings you look in the mirror and think it's Keith Richards. So it's I really get it. But also the small goals thing, I think, is hugely important. The best advice I ever got, and I wish I could remember who gave it, but they said, don't try to practice your instrument. And
no.
And then if you
hold on, Tom, we lost the important meaning of life there. We got about the practice of instruments. What was that again?
I said some of the best advice I ever got, and I wish I could remember who gave it, was don't try to commit yourself to an hour of practicing a day, let's say on your guitar. Commit yourself to 10 minutes. And if you've got the guitar in your hand for 10 minutes, you'll probably end up playing an hour anyway.
Beautiful. I really appreciate that. The small goals, and they could become larger. It's interesting that you see Keith Richards when you look in the mirror. Why is it that I see my father? but yeah, I know exactly what you mean. And Jill, I imagine that is not an uncommon scenario for the Wisconsin Institute for Healthy Aging.
It is not. It is not. We know that there's actually research that shows if you have a positive view of aging that you live 7.5 years longer, but that's not really the important part. The important part is you have a higher quality of life.
Yeah.
So that's really, it's, you know, some of us, I was at a conference once and they asked us, you know, how many of you want to live to be 100? And maybe half the people raised their hand, but not everybody. So it really is about quality of life. It depends on your quality of life. So, but we know that when you have a positive view of aging, you tend to take care of yourself better. You tend to engage with others a little bit more. So it plays into all those dimensions of wellness just by our own attitudes.
Have a tough email here from Gloria, who emails to say she'd like her widowed father to move from his house to a senior living facility, but she's worried about the mental stress it could induce, and he might feel like moving is somehow surrendering his independence and acknowledging that his life is, well, approaching the end. Dr. Walasek, what can Gloria do about this?
What a very poignant question, and I think that hits a lot of the issues that have to do with these sorts of transitions. So one of the more difficult transitions is when a person is facing difficulty living in their current situation and may benefit from living in another situation. One thought is sort of revisiting the current living situation, and could there be other things that could be done to help keep that person in that situation and have interactions with others and get the supports they need, whether it's some in-home caregiving or some scheduled activities outside of the house and so on. If that isn't possible or preferable, then a move to a setting like a senior living community or independent senior living or even assisted living, if there are needs, may be in the person's best interest, but that is going to activate all kinds of stuff around, am I losing my independence? I'm losing control over things of my life. I've got new routines to learn and new people to meet. So those could be challenges, and in the time leading up to it and the early part of the move, it could be a little more difficult. But the goal could be improvement over time, that because of being in an environment with other people and more opportunities to engage in others, the person will feel better. There may be additional supports in that setting, and so that'll help the person feel better. And so even though it will be stressful, I mean, it's a significant change in life, the hope would be that there's going to be a payoff on the other end in terms of better quality.
Appreciate that point of view. Let's go back to your questions and comments now for our guests, Jill Rankin from the Wisconsin Institute for Healthy Aging and Dr. Art Walasek from the UW School of Medicine and Public Health. Kate and Barneveld, good afternoon.
Hi, I apologize. I came to the conversation late, so forgive me if this perspective has already been shared. I feel like a really important way that we might combat both internal and external ageism is to surround ourselves throughout our lives with people of many generations, rather than, you know, like getting out of that age compartmentalizing bubble that we tend to live our lives in. I feel like I was surrounded my whole life, you know, from an early age on through today, with people who were older than I was, who still appeared vibrant and active and worthwhile. So I never had a sense of, you know, aging as being something negative, or that, you know, I hit the ripe old age of, you know, 40 or something and would suddenly cease to be relevant. And I'm finding that now in my early 50s that's really serving me well, because I don't see, you know, I don't see the end looming as such a big, dark, scary cloud. So I think, you know, going both directions, surrounding ourselves with people who are younger and older than us, is really the best way to combat this. And I'll just listen off the air. Thank you for the conversation.
Well, thank you for adding to the conversation, Kate. And Jill, what do you think of surrounding yourself with people of all ages?
Absolutely. We all have so much to give to each other at all ages. We do a whole lot of intergenerational programming here in Wisconsin and nationwide. It's really gaining some traction. And even if it's not programming, just on your own individual, in your own individual sphere, we have so much to contribute at all ages. If you think about it, even with intergenerational relationships, that Kate was just saying, we can learn from each other. We can learn in not only just facts and figures, but what about perspectives? And that really then feeds into social connection too. So as you're increasing your social connection and that sense of loneliness is dissipating, you're also increasing other parts of your health. So it's all connected.
It's funny how it's all connected when you stop to think about it, and how, you know, how you approach it can have a great degree of effect on the outcomes. We talked a little bit about chronic pain and how that can affect all the other aspects of health as you age. I want to ask about chronic cognitive problems, which also can become an issue as we get older. And Dr. Walasek, how do we deal with these in a way that protects our overall mental well-being?
Thank you so much for addressing that. So first off, unfortunately, with aging does come change in our cognition. Our memory is not as good over time. Some of our reasoning and other cognitive skills can change over time. That being said, as we've kind of already talked about earlier with learning, you know more as you get older. So knowledge and potentially wisdom all can increase over time. There's actually some interesting literature about attention actually gets better over time, up to about your mid-70s or so. So some things get worse, some things get better. Where we start to worry is if people develop memory or other brain changes that are worse than what we'd expect for their age, or if those things are affecting day-to-day life. And like things that pop up early on are driving difficulties. So people get lost driving or get into accidents. There could be a lot of reasons for that, but memory loss could be one of them. And then money management, that's often an early signal that someone is starting to have trouble cognitively.
Oh.
So if that happens, then that would require, we'd strongly recommend some medical attention and evaluation. And again, that would start in primary care with getting a good history of what's going on, thinking about medical conditions that might be contributing to memory loss, thinking about medications, alcohol, cannabis, other things that could be contributing to memory loss, addressing those. And then perhaps kind of further evaluation of the possibility of another cause of memory loss, like stroke or Alzheimer's disease or Parkinson's or other conditions. So that's kind of the stepwise way that we would think about addressing memory loss.
And Jill, how does the Wisconsin Institute for Healthy Aging help people challenged with memory loss and cognitive decline?
Sure. Overall, we don't usually focus on just one population. So we provide a variety of different opportunities for people with all different challenges and all different opportunities and strengths. So I would say, you know, we have evidence-based health promotion programs that one can engage with. I think of, you know, our fall prevention work. We have a lot of information on how memory affects falls and fall risk. So encourage you to, if that's something, that you're experiencing, we have lots of information on our Falls Free Wisconsin website, which is directly linked from ours, that you can just, you know, questions to ask your doctor, things that you might want to think about with home safety to make sure that as you're dealing with memory loss, what are some things that you can put into place to keep yourself safe? So things to think of with fall prevention is the biggest one. But overall, like I said, evidence-based programming that, you know, oversees our Living Well with Chronic Conditions program really addresses any kind of chronic condition, whether that is memory loss or that's anything else you're dealing with. And, you know, making those small goals, having caregivers involved in that is a big deal. And they're always invited to those kinds of programs. So we include caregivers in a lot of our work as well. So the more the merrier, I would say, is engage in health education and bring your family and your friends.
That website, again, for the Wisconsin Institute for Healthy Aging is wihealthyaging.org. That's wihealthyaging.org. And you'll find an abundant amount of resources there waiting for you at any time, or for others who may be looking for help as well. Please pass that along. And Jill and Dr. Walasek, I want to thank you both for a wonderful hour. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Jill Rankin is the executive director of the Wisconsin Institute for Healthy Aging and Dr. Art Walasek, professor of psychiatry and medicine at the University of Wisconsin School of Medicine and Public Health. I also want to thank our team today for making it all possible. Our producers, Clara Neipert, Joel Patenaude, our technical director, Jeff Robbins, and our executive producer is Jill Nadeau. I'm Lee Rayburn, in for Larry Mueller today. Join us for Garden Talk tomorrow from 11 to 1 here on The Larry Mueller Show. Melinda Myers returns. I'm Lee Rayburn, and this is The Larry Mueller Show on WPR News.